ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
War of the Worlds. Yes, it's on again, in lots of ways. But today on The Science Show, another look at the incredible man who wrote it, and why. Such a brain. H.G. Wells changed the way science was understood by the public. His writings and his warnings are part of the way we think today. The backdrop to all his work, both fiction and non-fiction, was what science will do in the future and what we will do with that knowledge, good or evil. Sharon Carleton starts today's program with H.G. describing his concern that there were no professional futurists in his day.
Though we have thousands and thousands of professors and hundreds of thousands of students of history working upon the records of the past, there is not a single person anywhere who makes a whole-time special job of estimating the future consequences of new inventions and new devices. There isn't a single professor of foresight in the world. But why shouldn't there? Isn't foresight as important as history?
Well, H.G. Wells was one of the fathers of science fiction. He was somebody who had an unparalleled ability to identify new developments in science and from them imagine how they would impact on the future. And he did this so well that in the early decades of the 20th century, pretty well all the leading physical scientists were reading him, not just for entertainment, but to see where their work might lead.
That was that Wells did not like the present and did not like the past. He felt that his parents had wanted him to be a shop assistant, and he hoped that the future would open things out to more interesting, exciting things than they were at the present.
Science writer Dr. Graham Farmelo and biographer Michael Sherborne. Over the decades since his death in 1946, Herbert George Wells has been described variously as a one-man think tank, the man who invented tomorrow, an ardent adulterer, the originator of a whole new genre of literature, and as the writer who represented an era by dreaming its nightmares for it. Wells most often described himself as a journalist.
Wells was a Renaissance man.
Dr. Roslyn Haynes, writer on H.G. Wells, an adjunct professor at the University of New South Wales.
He was a passionate universalist. He believed in internationalism, which he felt was the legacy of science. And he believed that the only way we could achieve that universalism was to do away with narrow nationalism, that we should think of ways to use the talents of young men, because he felt that the superfluous number of young men was what led to wars and had done all through history. And of course, we haven't changed that. Young people are still going off to join ISIS because they don't seem to know what else to do with themselves. But also, he was interested in communication of science, and that is a thing which we desperately need.
Michael Sherborne is the author of an excellent biography titled H.G. Wells, Another Kind of Life.
Well, unusually for an author of his day, Wells had taken a degree in science. He started out as a science teacher, a science journalist, and a writer of textbooks. And in his famous science fiction books, there's quite an amount of hard science in there. In 1930, he wrote an extensive guide to biology for the general reader, which he wrote with his son G.P. Wells, who became a science professor, and with Julian Huxley. In his later years, he was awarded a doctorate in science, and indeed he went to Australia in 1938 as a guest of honour of the Australian and New Zealand Association for the Advancement of Science. So he was a man who was seen as something of a spokesperson for science to the general public and was held in some esteem by the scientific community.
H.G., known more often as Bertie, was born the youngest of four children in Kent in the UK in September 1866 to a Bible-preaching mother, Sarah, and a lackadaisical father, Joe. His parents were unhappily married, unhappily working class and struggling, Not that Bertie ever actually starved, but he always blamed his small stature on having been deprived of proper nourishment as a child.
Wells was marked down to be a shop assistant by his parents, and that was a respectable job, but it was not one he wanted to do. He was a rebellious child. He fought his destiny. He annoyed his parents. He annoyed his employers. Also, a bright boy who loved to read and to argue, broke his leg at the age of 7, and from that period of enforced idleness, he became quite a keen reader. And I think the big thing in Wells's mind was that his mother, who was an evangelical Christian, believed that God had made the world and given you your place in it. The rich had their mansions, the poor had their hovels, and whatever you were assigned to, you were stuck with, really. Wells was very excited by the idea of evolution. If Darwin was right, then you weren't assigned to your place. You were an organism that was an experiment. There was no knowing what might become of you, what you might be able to do with your life, what your potential might be. I did rather tend to make science a religion and see it as a kind of monolithic source of information and ideas. I think these days we'd be much more sceptical about taking science as a guide in quite that way.
Wells remembered almost to the day when he totally lost his belief in religion and the idea of an omniscient God. He was 11 years old.
I feared hell dreadfully for some time. Hell was indeed good enough to prevent me calling either of my brothers fools. But one night I had a dream of hell so preposterous that it blasted that undesirable resort out of my mind forever. I had read of the punishment of breaking a man on the wheel. The horror of it got into my dreams, and there was our father in a particularly malignant phase, busy basting a poor broken sinner, roasting slowly over a fire built under the wheel. That dream pursued me into the daytime. Never had I hated God so intensely. And then, suddenly, the light broke through to me, and I knew this God was a lie.
His two utopian books, Anticipations and A Modern Utopia, are based very much on this belief that if everyone was educated in science and if everybody behaved according to the principles of science, we would have no wars, we would have no poverty, no unemployment, no mess, no waste, none of those things that he was trying to escape from. So yes, rationalism, as he understood science in his time, was for him the only future for the world. And if we didn't do it, then Homo sapiens would become extinct. And that was his great fear to the end of his life.
Faith might be out, but Wells also feared how science might be used by the unscrupulous. Wells's son, Anthony West.
Yes, he thought it was a dangerous business. The basic thing that kept human beings in touch with each other was the instinct that makes kittens snuggle with their mothers. A hugaboo was what the great emotions were born out of, and that if science stamped them out and men became entirely scientific, they would be very cruel to each other. I think there is a lot in that idea. The laboratory approach to human affairs is not a profitable one. But there is a scientific approach which involves getting the facts right, which is another matter. And he was in favour of that.
Wells wrote that
science is a match that man has just got alight. He thought he was in a room, in moments of devotion, a temple, and that his light would display walls inscribed with wonderful secrets and pillars carved with philosophical systems. It is a curious sensation, now that the preliminary splutter is over and the flame burns up clear, to see his hands lit and just a glimpse of himself and the patch he stands on visible. And around him, in place of all that human comfort and beauty he anticipated, darkness still.
After a few stops and starts, Wells eventually became a science teacher and wrote his first book, A Textbook of Biology, in 1893. He'd also married his cousin, Isabel Wells. Within a couple of years, the marriage was in trouble, and Wells ran off with a young pupil of his, Amy Catherine Robbins, whom he called Jane. She became his second wife in 1895, the same year he published his first science fiction book, The Time Machine.
The Time Traveller never ceases to amaze me. I was first writing about this when living in Cambridge, and I talked to so many of the scientists at the Cavendish Labs, and they all agreed that this was the first time that anybody had seriously thought about a fourth dimension. So at one level, the physics of the time machine are amazing for somebody to have grasped what the fourth dimension as time would involve. But much more than that, it looks at the logic of this. If you can in fact go into the future, what will happen? Will you change the past? In other words, will you change the present that you came from? And the Time Traveller explores this philosophically as well.
Roslyn Haynes from the University of New South Wales. The Time Machine is a disturbing story about a time traveller who pushes further and further towards the ends of the Earth, towards the death of our planet as the sun cools. Here, the traveller is explaining how he came up with his time machine.
Clearly, any real body must have extension in four directions. It must have length, breadth, thickness, and duration. But through a natural infirmity of the flesh, we incline to overlook this fact. There are really four dimensions, three which we call the three planes of space, and a fourth, time. There is no difference between time and any of the three dimensions of space, except that our consciousness moves along it.
This science romance, as he called it, brought Wells instant fame and launched the time travel genre. This is Wells reflecting later in life.
You might even think there's something malicious about the future, as though it didn't like to be prophesied about and dodged one. I thought that I was pretty safe to take my time machine some millions of years ahead and show the sun cooled down to a red ball and the earth dried up and frozen. That was what science made of the outlook in 1893. But since then, all sorts of mitigating considerations have arisen, and there is no reason, they tell us now, to suppose it will not be humanity or the descendants of humanity living in comfort and sunshine on this planet for millions of years yet, provided always they do not blow to pieces in some great war climax. You see, you never can tell.
Wells returned to the theme of unchecked scientific progress in his next science romance, The Island of Dr. Moreau, in 1896. A story about animals being manipulated by an amoral scientist, animals given human parts. It explores the boundaries of cruelty and pain, of evolution, which was still a pretty new idea at the time, about what makes us human. Marlon Brando starred as Dr. Moreau in the 1996 film adaptation of the book.
Move back! Back! Why have you done this?
People that you witnessed before, living under my care and protection, are animals that have been fused with human genes. In the course of a series of scientific studies designed by myself.
I mean, this is just satanic.
For 17 years, I have been striving to create some measure of refinement in the human species, you see. And it is here, on this very island, that I, sir, have found the very essence of the devil.
What do you mean?
I have seen the devil in my microscope, and I have chained him. And I suppose you could say, in a sense, metaphorically speaking, I've cut him to pieces. The devil, Mr. Douglas, I found, is nothing more than a tiresome collection of genes
I don't see how any of this specious nonsense justifies these monstrous disfigurements.
Well, very simply, they represent a stage in the process of the eradication of destructive elements found in the human psyche. And I've almost achieved perfection, you see, of a divine creature. It is pure, harmonious, absolutely incapable of malice. And if in my tinkering I have fallen short of the human form by the odd snout, claw, or hoof, it really is of no great import.
Dr. Moreau is an amazing character. He exiles himself from England because he's in big trouble as a vivisectionist, and he sets up on Nobles Island to create something that today we would think of as a genetically engineered cross species of the beast people, as he calls them. And he feels that, yes, he has a right to do this because he is, in fact, reenacting the kind of creator who would be predicted from evolutionary theory as it was understood at that time. That nature is cruel, nature has much waste in evolution, there is much pain and suffering and loss of organisms that didn't make it. Wells is very mindful of Huxley's position on evolution, which was that we must not try to derive an ethic from evolution, because if we do, we will lose anything resembling civilization. And that's exactly what happens in Moreau's little kingdom, that the beasts turn against him and, of course, eventually kill him. And this speaks to us in terms of genetic engineering, cloning, anything that we haven't really thought through the ethical future of.
Wells had studied for a time under the great Thomas Henry Huxley, a fervent Darwinian, and it's not hard to see his influence on Wells. This is H.G. recorded in 1938, describing a class with Professor Huxley.
Before him, among other objects, was a dead rabbit. He took up and stroked the little body as he sketched the cycle of its life. Here was something that had just been living. We were going to see in the laboratory how it was made, how its body worked, how it was related to other and similar forms. He pointed out to us some of its chief distinctions from other kindred species and some of its main resemblances to other types. We were going to ask ourselves, what was, what is this life? What was it had held this small furry individual together? Made it run, eat, and play? What animated it? How was that race related to other living races? That little, limp, furry body was the key by which we were to make our way towards the understanding of the whole incessant network of life. His work was done in a very crucial phase of human thought. The human intelligence was breaking away from the belief that the world had been made as a going concern by a special act called creation. But the men of science of the past century were turning more and more against this creationism. This new conception was called evolution, and throughout the whole 19th century, the struggle went on between these two systems of thought, between orderly evolution and impulsive creationism. The human mind.
He was one of the top students in the college in his first year when Huxley was the leader of the course and he was doing biology. After that, he kind of lost interest. He got into literature and politics and philosophy, which also interested him, and rather neglected his studies and left without his degree. But he did go back and take the degree later, and I think the vision of biology was the thing that appealed to him. I think the geology and the physics wasn't so interesting. It was the idea of evolution and experiment of the individual organism finding its way in life and finding its niche that appealed to him.
Today on The Science Show, we're commemorating the life and scientific prophecies of H.G. Wells. Wells wrote nearly 50 full-length novels and 80 short stories, along with hundreds of essays, social critiques, letters, histories, film scripts, pamphlets, and newspaper articles. There was always a message, or many messages, within Wells's books. The Invisible Man, written in 1897, looked at moral corruption made possible by scientific discovery. Griffin, the scientist, explains his invisibility breakthrough.
"It's simple enough and credible enough," said Griffin, putting the serviette aside and leaning the invisible head on an invisible hand. "Consider, visibility depends on the action of the visible bodies on light. Either a body absorbs light, or it reflects or refracts it, or does all these things. If it neither reflects nor refracts nor absorbs light, it cannot of itself be visible. A transparent thing becomes invisible if it is put in any medium of almost the same refractive index."
There might have been the odd flaw, but overall the physics seemed to be on the mark.
David Powell is a research fellow in physics at the ANU in Canberra.
His idea is that if you have a material, if its refractive index is 1, that's the refractive index of air or vacuum, then there is no reflection or refraction and you can eliminate absorption. And from the physics we know that if an object does none of those things, then you genuinely cannot see it. We have no known way of doing that to an object, let alone a living person. Although there are some things along that line that can be done for very small particles by cancelling out the properties of the material by something with an opposite response, but certainly not going to work for a whole person. The modern approach is instead to make sure the light never hits the object in the first place. Well, there are actually really quite a variety of different experiments have been shown in the literature of a whole bunch of different ways of achieving some kind of cloaking or invisibility. I guess all of them have a little bit of a catch that's probably not usually mentioned in press releases. So some of them will only work over a certain range of wavelengths. So that means if you are talking about visible light, you might be only invisible to one very specific colour. Others don't have that limitation, but only work for example, very small objects that are so small you'd need a microscope to see them anyway. Then there's something known as the carpet cloak, which is a lot easier to achieve, but it only works if the object you want to cloak is standing in front of a mirror. Then there are yet other approaches that only work from one exact direction, or there are other ones where you can cloak the object, but the cloak itself can still be hidden. So it seems so far that there's no solution that doesn't have some major catch. I guess the real question is, do the laws of physics prevent us from ever overcoming these, or is it just a question of technology?
What do you think?
I think probably the laws of physics mean that we can never make an object completely invisible in the true sense, but I don't think they prevent us from having an object that's invisible enough, if you like, or difficult to see, which, you know, if you're talking military applications, that may well be good enough.
In 1898, the famous British astronomer Percival Lowell had astounded the public by claiming that he'd seen canals on the surface of Mars. What's more, they'd been made by some sort of intelligent beings. That same year, Wells published his most successful and enduring science fiction book, The War of the Worlds, about a Martian invasion. It spawned 1,000 more books, films, comics, plays, and dissertations. Martians land in southern England wanting to take over the Earth. They're vastly advanced war machines with deathly heat rays obliterate their Earthling targets. Mass panic ensues. Scientists fail to come up with an answer. The Martians are finally defeated, not by our technology, but by our biology. They have no defense against human germs. This is the opening of Jeff Wayne's musical version of The War of the Worlds, made in the 70s and starring Richard Burton.
No one would have believed in the the last years of the 19th century, that human affairs were being watched from the timeless worlds of space. No one could have dreamed we were being scrutinized as someone with a microscope studies creatures that swarm and multiply in a drop of water. Few men even considered the possibility of life on other planets. And yet, across the gulf of space, minds immeasurably superior to ours regarded this Earth with envious eyes. And slowly and surely, they drew their plans against us.
Andrew White is Professor of Physics at Queensland University and a world leader in quantum technology. He's also an HG fan.
So Wells was spotted in two ways. One, before he'd become a well-known writer and serialist, he was a science teacher and he was very aware of the cutting science around him. So in the book, he's got accurate descriptions of microscopy, biology, telescopes, and he speculated a little bit with death rays. It was an extension of Maxwell's equations, which Heaviside only 12 years before had shrunk down to 4 equations, which was a really big thing and well discussed at the time.
That's James Clerk Maxwell's equations?
James Clerk Maxwell. His original paper was 40 years before, but it had 12 equations. It was unwieldy. And a guy called Oliver Heaviside had shrunk it to 4 equations just 12 years before and made it very accessible to people. And he speculated correctly. I'm wearing a pair of jeans at the moment, and they were cut by Wellsian death rays. We call them carbon dioxide lasers, but they are more or less what he had in mind. Invisible beams of radiation, heat, concentrated heat. Of course, we haven't ended up militarizing them in quite the way he thought. It's still much cheaper to fire a bullet at somebody. And instead, we're using them as tools. There are even research labs around the world that are now reaching inside cells, holding a cell with light, cutting it open with light, reaching into it with another light beam, and with a fourth light beam, turning things around.
On Horsell Common, the Martians continued hammering and stirring, sleepless, indefatigable, at work upon the machines they were making. Now and again a light, like the beam of a warship's searchlight, swept the common, and the heat ray was ready to follow.
Actually, I think he was reflecting what he saw in the world around him. War of the Worlds was written as a response to the genocide of the Tasmanian, or attempted genocide of the Tasmanian Aboriginals. Apparently he was having a conversation with a friend about it and said, can you imagine what it would be like to have such superior technology turn up very quickly and take your land? I think he was actually reflecting on what was then current practice in the imperial powers.
Wells loathed colonialism in all forms and asked if we, the human race, are such apostles of mercy as to complain if the Martians warred in the same spirit? This is Wells speaking in 1943 when he was in his 70s.
There are claptrap phrases about backward races and inferior peoples. These are the foolish excuses by which those who still hope to go on at an advantage over their fellow creatures camouflage their own foolishly based dreams. There are no backward races. All over the earth, babies start scratch, full of distinctive and untried possibilities, which the new world will develop eagerly. Here you will find folk with a superlative sense of rhythm, like the Negro. Here, great mechanical genius, like the Australian blackbird. Here, a gift of system, like the French, or an obstinate, unteachable originality of thought, like the English. If our World Educational Organization has its schools everywhere, all that is needed to cover the whole world with schools, and in the multitude of quickened minds, this struggle has evoked a supply of men and women who have discovered that by teaching, we learn.
Thank you.
As the century turned, so did Wells's interests, away from scientific fantasy to saving the world from itself. Rosalind Haynes.
I think there's a number of strands of his non-fictional work that does speak to us today. In Anticipations and A Modern Utopia, he tried to predict what the world would be like. Now, we have to remember that Anticipations was published in 1901 and A Modern Utopia in 1905. And it was on the basis of these two books that he was hailed as the prophet of the future. But also he had a very strong belief that we had to do away with unemployment. And when I think of the millions of refugees in the world, hopefully or hopelessly wandering in search of employment and a place to live, this was the thing that Wells really predicted and said the only way to sort this would be to have a world state. And everyone would be a citizen of a world state. They would migrate to wherever the particular work that they could do was available, and that this would solve so many of the sociological problems. Poverty, the unemployed young men not knowing what to do with themselves, that there would be so much more leisure for people to explore ideas and art and music. And he saw this as a wonderful utopian culture. But again, I guess it had what we might think of as a sinister side, in that people who were not worthy to have children, in other words, who would be bad parents, were not permitted to have children because they were not adequate to bring them up in the proper way. He would have been a proponent of negative eugenics, and as many of the thinkers of his time were. It was not considered pre the Nazi era as anything too shocking, but simply what all breeders did. And this, of course, had influenced Darwin himself.
Wells believed war was the inevitable conclusion of nationalism, of sovereign states, and he feared the worst when it came to the use of science in that warfare. He predicted the tank, aerial battles, and perhaps most prescient of all, the atomic bomb. In 1914, he wrote The World Set Free, where he imagined a uranium-based bomb that would continue to explode indefinitely. His fictional professor of physics explains,
"This little bottle contains about a pint of uranium oxide. In the atoms in this bottle, there slumbers at least as much energy as we could get by burning 160 tons of coal. If in one instant I could suddenly release that energy, it would blow us and everything around us into fragments."
Wells was not the greatest scientist, but he was a science graduate at Imperial College in London, which he passed at the second attempt.
Science writer Graham Farmello.
And he did keep abreast of new science. And he read an account of the relatively new phenomenon of radioactivity, where atoms appear to fall apart to transmute into different types of atoms. That account was written by Frederick Soddy, who was a leading expert in this field. And on one particular page of that account, which was called The Interpretation of Radium, Soddy talked about the huge amounts of energy locked up in atoms, and that's liberated through radioactivity. This was classic H.G. Wells, because in that line or two in that book, he saw the potential to release huge amounts of energy. We now call that energy nuclear energy, because it's stored in the atomic nucleus at the core of atoms. And what Wells did was write a story where humankind harnessed that energy to power economies, but also to build weapons of unprecedented destructiveness. And it was in doing that that he coined the term atomic bombs. He was the person who coined that phrase that's now caught on so well.
The World Set Free was published almost three decades before the Manhattan Project and the development of nuclear weapons.
Never before in the history of warfare had there been a continuing explosive. and these atomic bombs, which science burst upon the world that night, were strange, even to the men who used them.
Well, the science was under very close investigation at the time. First-rate scientists were trying to understand radioactivity. Now, Wells, by the time he wrote the book that featured atomic bombs, and that book's called The World Set Free, which he wrote in his love nest in Switzerland with the Australian writer Elizabeth von Arnim. When they weren't making love, he was busy writing this book. And he envisaged certain powers getting hold of those weapons. Now, almost nobody had thought of that. The key thing that he got was that the release of a large amount of energy, of nuclear energy, could be a game changer. He envisaged that, and he envisaged that it could be dramatic. The two planes shot down in flames. Eisenhower held to blame. Russia demands an apology. Will this end in World War III? What do they need these weapons for? Will mankind survive the next war? Are they targeting New York? Why don't they just sit down and talk? All that we...
An excerpt from the rock musical Atomic by Danny Gingas and Philip Foxman, about Leo Szilard, a Hungarian-born physicist who worked in Germany until the rise of the Nazis when he moved to London. In the same way as Wells had, Szilard recognised both the possibilities of harnessing atomic energy as well as the dangers.
Like virtually all other leading scientists, Szilard read Wells. This really can't be stressed enough. Wells was somebody who was not just admired and enjoyed by the public, but by scientists as well. And Szilard hit on this idea of the nuclear chain reaction, which means that you could have a subnuclear particle called the neutron colliding with a nucleus, splitting it apart, giving rise to more neutrons that would then split apart more uranium nuclei and so on and so on and so on, giving more and more energy out. And that we now see as a nuclear chain reaction. And Szilard, in crossing a street in London in autumn 1933, had this epiphany that this may make possible a weapon of unprecedented destructiveness. And he read Wells, and that triggered Szilard's imagination to extrapolate to the future, so to speak, and imagine what impact this would have on world affairs. And that made Szilard a very big player in this field as he sought to bring to other scientists and administrators the prospect of that bomb being used in warfare.
And I gather he actually put one of H.G. Wells's books in the library at Los Alamos when they went there.
Yes, he did. And he spent months trying to alert the scientists, in particular the scientists who worked with Lord Rutherford, who was, if you like, the king of the nucleus. Rutherford had discovered the nucleus and named it and done a lot of work on it. And he and his colleagues were working on this subject, and Szilard was desperately trying to alert them of the possibility of this weapon. And largely they poo-pooed it, it has to be said. He was way ahead. What he didn't have... this is very important to realise. What he didn't have was a method or an account of how you could build that bomb. He simply suspected that it could exist.
So tell me about Churchill's fascination for Wells, because that was also to do with his predicting the future of military weapons, wasn't it?
H.G. Wells was someone Churchill hugely admired. Later, Churchill said that he read all of Wells's books twice. Not once, twice. So it's almost certain that Churchill, in 1914, when The World Set Free was published, that he read about atomic bombs for the first time there. And Churchill, later in his career, became the leader who was the first to foster research into that kind of weapon.
Graham Farmello, science writer and author of the book Churchill's Bomb. Wells became a political figure of great note, a celebrated intellectual with influence. He campaigned against apartheid, the class system, poverty, and for the emancipation of women, for new ways of education, for the environment, for medical research into diabetes, which he had, and also, integral to his own life, for sexual freedom of both sexes. Wells had more than 100 lovers, 2 wives, a handful of long-term mistresses, and 4 children. Rebecca West, the feminist writer and one of those mistresses, said, "His obsession with sex lay clotted over his books like cold white sauce."
Yes, I think Wells was an organism. He saw himself as a biological organism, and I think his sex drive was a very big part of what he did. He also found it useful, I think, to hang out with women who were imaginative and thoughtful, and he found their conversation and their ideas stimulating as well. I always think one of the reasons Wells was so successful as an adulterer, along with him being very famous, of course, which I think helped, was that he actually was interested in women. My impression is that most men in the first half of the 20th century, certainly most eminent men, didn't take women very seriously. They saw them as the people who made the tea, while the men got their cigars out and debated politics. Whereas Wells actually was very interested in everybody's opinions. If you were a dustman, if you were a girl student, whoever you were, Wells wanted to hear what you had to say, and he was very curious to engage with you. And I think women did appreciate that about him. They could talk to him about serious things, and he wasn't just chatting them up. He was genuinely interested in what they had to say.
He was also fairly open about all these liaisons, wasn't he?
Yes, I don't think it's much of a secret. If you were a progressive young woman in the 1920s, to go to bed with H.G. Wells was part of the deal, really. He hadn't really made it unless he slept with Wells. Of course, he had to keep it out of the papers. That would have been a problem. But, of course, in those days, it was more of a closed system. He knew all the newspaper proprietors, and a quick phone call would get any story killed.
In appraising Michael Sherborne's biography of Wells, London's Camden Review put it this way.
"Sex bomb. Today's tabloids would have massacred H.G. Wells, who chased girls like a rampant bull left free in a cowshed to enjoy himself. Passion dominated his life. He made love on the beach, in the woods, on hillsides, in church, and once even on a newspaper displaying an adverse review of one of his novels."
H.G. Wells' son with Rebecca West, Anthony West, disagreed with this idea of his father being a womanizer, an ardent adulterer. He's speaking here to an Ohio University interviewer in 1984.
"He was not a notorious womanizer. You forget what sort of a period he lived in. He was born in 1866, and he was a young man in 1886. He was still a young man when he started with my mother in 1912. In all that time, England was swarming with prostitutes. Every Western country was. And no middle-class businessman thought anything about going and knocking it off with a prostitute on his way home after he'd been at the office, or going out during the evening saying to his wife, 'I'll be dining at the club tonight.' He'd be going out with some woman at the time. Sex was something rather unpleasant you didn't inflict on your wife. When you wanted sex and physical pleasure, he went with a bought woman, and he didn't bother your wife, who was made of finer fibre than that sort of thing. And he lived in a transitional phase and did something to make it a transitional phase. And I think his notion was that people would be very much happier doing things on a non-commercial and non-sordid basis. It was a better life that he was advocating. Free love was not a new promiscuity. It was a more honest and candid way of approaching sex."
"The type of man that I conceive emerging into the coming years will deal simply and logically not only with the business of death, but with birth. At present, the sexual morality of the civilized world is the most illogical and incoherent system of wild permissions and insane prohibitions, foolish tolerance and ruthless cruelty that it is possible to imagine. Our current civilization is a sexual lunatic."
Well, the science fiction is what Wells is remembered for, and I suppose that's the stuff that will last. But Wells wrote many books which deserve to be read still. He wrote these wonderfully sociably subversive comedies, Kipps and the History of Mr. Polly particularly. He wrote some very good mainstream novels, Tono Bungay, New Machiavelli, I think after the war. which he had encouraged people to take part in, he wanted to get a perspective on human history and say, okay, here's how the war fits into it and what is the way forward. So he sat down, spent a year of his life with support from his wife Jane, writing this massive history of the world. He published it in fortnightly parts, so it will be accessible for ordinary people with colour illustrations and photographs. And it was an enormous bestseller. It made him famous as an international figure. The Science of Life didn't work quite so well. I think, again, it was published in parts. He co-wrote that with G.P. Wells and Julian Huxley. And that's, again, a remarkable book for its day, but heavier going, I think, because it's got a lot more hard science in, and therefore it's a bit more of a plough to read through. But certainly it was a remarkable example of Wells putting a huge effort in to try to make science available to the ordinary person in the street, and that was something he was very keen to do. He wrote a book called World Brain, I think, in 1938, which has recently been taken up by many people, because there he talks about information overload, the problem of getting up-to-date, reliable information in a world where so much is coming out, and the need to try and find some mechanism to make that available to ordinary people. And he addressed various library associations and wrote it all up as this book, World Brain. Of course, people now say, well, the World Wide Web is what he was talking about.
This is Wells, the social reformer. He wanted a permanently accessible encyclopedia which would be available to all. Wikipedia says, a number of commentators have suggested that Wikipedia represents the world brain as described by Wells, and he did so in the 1930s. Jonathan Stoy's grandfather was Jip Wells, who worked with Julian Huxley and H.G. on this ideal.
It was very hard work. H.G. insisted on, let's say, 1,000 words a day that had to be maintained. They had to go on until that was finished. And he also said that the time to hurry is at the beginning. At the end, where you're trying to tidy up, there will be lots of things to do. But you really have got to hurry from the very beginning to move the project forward as fast as possible. I'm not certain how pleasurable an experience that was. Both my grandfather and the other co-author Huxley gave up their jobs in order to work on this book. He felt very strongly that knowledge was to be the saviour, that people should be educated as best they can be, and there were these two books, well, there was in fact a third because there was one on the economy to follow, that were designed to tell everyone about everything. The Outline of History was an enormous success in financial terms. I think The Science of Life slightly less so. But nevertheless, it was read by lots of people, and they were used, particularly in schools in the US, for many years.
In the late 1930s, H.G. Wells visited Australia for the first time as a guest speaker at ANZUS, the science conference.
I came here to learn what I could from the Australian and the New Zealand Association for the Advancement of Science, which has just been meeting at Canberra. All the men and women in that association, I warn you, are utopians. And they believe their utopia is real. They believe that this world of ours can only be put in order and kept in order by the perpetual refreshment of scientific thought. They believe as firmly as any human beings have ever believed that swords can be beaten into plowshares and spears into pruning hooks. That nation need not lift up its hand against nation, nor should they learn war anymore. But they do not prophesy that that will certainly happen. They say, if only you would.
Wells's 5 weeks in Australia were overfilled with radio broadcasts, talks and interviews. His main message was the need for a radical reorganisation of the entire world's education system. He believed that human history becomes more and more a race between education and catastrophe. His audience appeared mildly interested.
I do not seem to have had a suspicion that there was such a force as social inertia to be reckoned with.
It was Wells's political views which caused trouble. He talked about Germany's leaders as certified lunatics suffering from delusions of grandeur and a contagious form of homicidal mania. Roslyn Haynes.
following Chamberlain's policy of appeasement, the Australian government's official line was that we should be not saying bad things about Hitler or Mussolini. And Wells most certainly did, and indeed was asked to calm down what he said, or he would be asked to leave the country.
Yes, he quite upset the Prime Minister at the time, Joe Lyons, yes, didn't he, by criticising Hitler?
Yes, and ironically, a few months after he got back to England, war was declared.
Suppression neither begins nor ends with Mr. Lyons. It is like a malaise all over Australian public affairs. He is only a self-projected sample. The Australian Broadcasting Commission is less degraded on the whole than the BBC. That is one up for Australia. But much the same bullying of street corner orators, pickets and strikers is encouraged at home.
It's the mid-1940s. H.G. Wells was then in his late 70s. He was overweight, his health was bad, and his last campaign was to help humanity help itself, to work out what were the rights of man.
Wells began by thinking that he would do the same sort of thing as the First World War. He'd be campaigning for a world government and better regulation of affairs to try and prevent wars. But then the light bulb came on over his head and he thought, well, actually, no, we need something more specific than this, something perhaps less ambitious. What we want is a new Magna Carta, we want a charter of the rights of man so that all countries can be held accountable in the way that they treat people and we can get a fair deal for everyone in the world and then we can move forward from that. And so he began this campaign for the rights of man. He wrote several books about it. He campaigned in the newspapers. He was denounced by the Nazis vociferously for this. And of course it influenced the Roosevelts in America, which led to the UN Declaration of Human Rights. And in fact, this is something which Wells doesn't get credit for, because being Wells and being a very argumentative man, he managed to annoy so many people and insult so many politicians during the course of the campaign that eventually he agreed to take his name off the whole thing, and it became called the Sankey Declaration of Human Rights. But in fact, Wells did a huge and a very, very influential campaign in the 40s, and really that goes on today. A lot of the human rights arguments going on today proceed from what Wells did.
H.G. Wells died in 1946, just weeks before his 80th birthday, having refused to leave London despite the Blitz. He died a year after his darkest prophecy about atomic warfare was realised in Japan. He had already written his own epitaph.
I told you so, you damned fools.
What an incredible man, H.G. Wells. His novels are still compelling, and his work on STEM, as it's now called, inspired generations. That was written and presented by Sharon Carlton, production by Mark Don and David Fisher, readings by Tim Rubin. And in the Science Show next week, Australia's hottest 100 scientists, including Michelle Simmons and Catherine Ball. Why should you know who they are and what they do? It's our future in their hands, and they need your support. I'm Robin Williams, and see you then.
Listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.